What does it mean when a nation elects its first Black president, yet police continue killing unarmed Black citizens with impunity? When Michael Brown's body lay in a Ferguson, Missouri street for 4.5 hours under the scorching August sun, something broke open in America. His parents were held back at gunpoint, unable to reach their son. The world watched as tanks rolled through suburban streets, as military-grade weapons pointed at unarmed protesters, as a 95% white police force wore I.M. Darren Wilson wristbands while tear gas filled the air. This wasn't just another tragedy, it was a reckoning. The contradiction between Barack Obama in the White House and Mike Brown on the pavement exposed a painful truth. Formal equality doesn't guarantee actual freedom. Kianga Yamanta Taylor's work doesn't offer comfortable narratives about progress. Instead, it forces us to confront how racism operates in contemporary America, not as individual prejudice, but as systemic machinery grinding away at Black lives. Think about how we talk about racism today. Someone isn't considered racist unless they use explicit slurs or join the Klan. This narrow definition was engineered. After the civil rights victories of the 1960s, when the Black Power movement had become so influential that corporate executives anonymously confessed they feared capitalism's collapse, America's elite needed a new strategy. Richard Nixon's answer was brilliant in its cruelty: colorblindness. Rather than defending segregation openly, he redefined racism as purely about individual intentions. Institutional discrimination became freedom of choice. Different outcomes reflected poor choices rather than systemic barriers. Just as the post-war economic boom ended, precisely when massive investment in Black communities was most needed, the political establishment declared that acknowledging institutional racism was itself racist. This wasn't just Nixon's conservative project. By disconnecting contemporary poverty from centuries of discrimination, colorblindness became the default framework across the political spectrum. It allowed politicians to slash social programs while blaming Black communities for their own suffering. When Black families have $6,000 in average wealth compared to $1.2 million for the richest Black families, colorblindness obscures how the system creates these outcomes, turning structural violence into personal failure. American police kill nearly 1,000 people annually. Canada reported 78 in a year. England had 4 from 2010 to 2014. Germany had none in 2013-2014. China, with 4.5 times America's population, recorded just 12 in 2014. Young Black men ages 15 to 19 are 21 times more likely to be killed by police than white peers, a disparity that worsened from 9 to 1 in 2006-2008. Modern American policing evolved directly from slave patrols. After emancipation, Black codes criminalized poverty and normal activities exclusively for African Americans. The 13th Amendment's loophole, allowing slavery for the incarcerated, enabled convict leasing. By 1898, nearly 73% of Alabama's revenue came from leasing convicts to coal mines. Police captured the labor force. This legacy continues through the war on drugs and Clinton's crime regime. America houses 25% of the world's prisoners, despite having only 5% of the global population. Since 1971, the prison population has grown by 700% to 2.4 million. Comstat and broken windows policing rewarded high arrest numbers. In New York, police stops skyrocketed from 175,000 in 1998-1999 to 684,000 by 2011, overwhelmingly targeting Black and Latino men. In Ferguson, 16,000 outstanding warrants existed in a city of 21,000 people. Court fines constituted 21% of city revenue. Municipal kleptocracy dressed as law enforcement. 8 months after Ferguson, Baltimore erupted when Freddie Gray died from a brutal police beating. But Baltimore was different. The mayor was Black, the police commissioner was Black, most of the city council was Black. Three of the six officers involved in Gray's death were African American, as was the presiding judge. If representation was the answer, why was the outcome the same? The rise of Black political power reveals calculated co-optation. Carl Stokes became Cleveland's first Black mayor in 1967, heavily supported by civil rights organizations. Yet he appointed a white veteran police chief despite police brutality catalyzing the 1966 uprising, prioritized business interests in urban renewal, and upgraded police weaponry after a 1968 rebellion. African Americans gained political control of major cities precisely when facing depleted tax bases and deindustrialization. By the 1990s, Black elected officials supported devastating legislation. Clinton's 1994 crime bill expanded the death penalty, imposed life sentences for nonviolent offenses, added 100,000 more police, eliminated federal funding for inmate education, and allocated $10 billion for prison construction. The richest Black families now have 200 times more wealth than the average Black family. Only 1.4% of Black families belong to America's richest 1%. These civil rights entrepreneurs now oversee privatization of public services, invoking the same racist stereotypes as white officials to mask their complicity. When Mike Brown was killed, police released video suggesting he'd stolen cigarros, framing him as a bad victim who deserved his fate. This distinction between deserving and undeserving Black victims perpetuates America's oldest mythology, that Black suffering stems from cultural deficiencies rather than systemic oppression. Republican Paul Ryan decries inner cities trapped in a tailspin of culture. Democrat Rahm Emanuel claims gun violence is not about crime, it's about values. Both narratives erase actual history. The American dream promised opportunity based on ability, but post-war prosperity depended on government subsidies disguised as private enterprise. Federal mortgage guarantees for suburban housing excluded most African Americans, while businesses relocated to suburbs, abandoning cities and their jobs. American exceptionalism masks three central historical themes: genocide, slavery, and immigrant worker exploitation. This narrative serves both parties because addressing institutional racism would demand massive wealth redistribution and undermine America's self-image as moral leader. Instead, we get endless lectures about culture and personal responsibility while oppression continues. Ashley Yates of Millennials United understood what others missed. "We knew that the system had already failed. The murder of Mike Brown was another example of how the systems in place made it acceptable to gun us down." Young Ferguson activists connected policing to broader patterns of racism and inequality. Black women emerged as central organizers, though their names remain less familiar. While Eric Garner and Mike Brown became household names, Rekia Blade, Shelley Frey, Miriam Carey, and Alberta Spruill, all killed by police, received far less attention. As Brittany Farrell noted, if it were not for Black women, there would be no movement. Census data revealed a devastating reality. Over 40% of Black men in key age groups were missing from Ferguson due to imprisonment or premature death. When a grand jury failed to indict Darren Wilson, Ferguson erupted. 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot within seconds while playing with a toy gun. When Daniel Pantaleo wasn't indicted for Eric Garner's choking death, despite video evidence, massive protests erupted nationwide. The rallying cry, "Black Lives Matter," spread rapidly. Congressional aides staged walkouts, athletes wore "I Can't Breathe" shirts, students organized die-ins. The movement exposed a buried truth: inclusion in a fundamentally unjust system doesn't bring liberation. Martin Luther King Jr. recognized America's problems were systemic rather than superficial, rooted in racism, materialism, and militarism. He died supporting striking sanitation workers, linking racial justice to economic justice to human dignity. Capitalism requires division to maintain exploitation. White supremacy deflects class tensions toward Black people while obscuring economic differences between rich and poor whites. racism becomes a mechanism for the powerful to justify rule, accumulate wealth, and maintain control. Capitalism, racism, and class rule are so deeply intertwined that Black liberation is impossible within the current system. Building movements against police violence, poverty, and oppression remains critical. Through these struggles, people learn to organize and challenge the status quo. Day-to-day resistance must connect to what Michael Dawson calls pragmatic utopianism, starting with current conditions while imagining a better future. When Black movements gain momentum, they challenge the entire mythology of American freedom and democracy. The question isn't whether change is possible, it's whether we have the courage to demand not inclusion in a broken system, but its complete transformation. Because 150 years from slavery's formal end proves one thing: formal equality without actual freedom is just another form of bondage.